Five, four, three, two, one.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on. The all-new Panic Room Radio Show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, good evening. It is the new Panic Room, and it's episode 242 on the 19th of August, 2021. And it's been a few weeks since we were last on the air. Mostly because I moved house, which is this is the first show coming to you from my colonial mansion, as we call it. Because we've got a veranda, it's a balcony, to be honest with you. But we're kind of proud of it. So, but here we are, back and in full effect, and not broadcasting from my bedroom anymore, which makes a nice change. And I miss Xtina. I do, you know, she's a little ray of sunshine in my otherwise dull life, but which doesn't bode well for my life, really. But I think we should bring her on. How are you doing?
Oh, the little ray of sunshine is not feeling so sunshiny today.
No, you've got pulled your tooth, bless your little heart. I know. And a bit, you know, don't go on about it, you know. If you don't, just
no,
don't.
I had, and wait, so not only did I, you know, have the dentist today and the, you know, that's always fun, but, you know, Skype would not work for me tonight, so I'm calling in on my phone. And, you know, I have the cool little microphone now, and I can't use it, so I feel like it's just been a bad day, James.
Well, you know, it makes, you know, all the stress I've had of, you know, buying a house and moving and all the rest of it. We kids and animals and puppies, because of course we have the puppies now.
Oh, God.
Pales into insignificance, you know, against your little bit of toothache, to be honest with you. So, I'm humbled. But it's funny because I was sitting here preparing for the show, and I was four, you know, those big black flies, you know, because I've had the back door open because the dogs have been in and out and whatnot, and these fucking great big flies had come in, and they were buzzing around my desk, and I've been picking them off one by one. It's been like a fly horror movie, you know, and I've been picking them off one by one. You know, one of them, I've got this fly swatter thing, well, literally sat on the fly swatter, and it's looking at me like, go on, fat boy, I dare you. You could see defiance on its little insect face. It was like, go on, what are you going to do now, fatty? But I did manage to kill it, and I think what I'm going to do during the show is I'm going to behead them, put their little heads on little cocktail sticks and sort of set them up around the room as a warning to the other flies not to come in. And I think they will. But there is this... The final fly is still buzzing around. He's just the last one that, by horror film rules, really, he's going to kill me, you know. But not completely dead, because I've got to come back to the sequel, you know. So if suddenly there's this horrible sounds of death and murder and whatnot, it's the final fly getting his sort of convoluted, turn the table sort of revenge on me. So... you know, this should be a video podcast, because, you know, that would add to the excitement.
I would love
although
to
having
see
said that,
that
I would, it would mean I would have to put clothes on. So, you know, let's not.
I know. After I got back from the dentist, I was just like, I'm putting on my frumpy clothes today. And I've had like, you know, it's not quite the pajamas, but it's like the one step before the pajamas. And, you know, that's what I've been in today. And I've taken
naps. What do you mean frumpy clothes? That's my day wear. Seriously. My pajama pants and my sort of, you know, redneck wife beater sleeveless shirt. And I think it's funny. I actually got to the point this afternoon, and I'm sat, and I honestly could not remember the last time I had a shower or change.
Oh,
and I thought maybe I had to pop out to the pet store to buy some crickets for Lena, as you do. And I thought I really need a shower before I do that.
And I don't think that our listeners knew that I have acquired a new baby it's been almost 2 weeks now. A little ball python.
He's gorgeous.
You know, two months old. He's just a little bitty thing, and I'm excited because tonight is his feeding night. So hopefully that goes well. He ate for us last week, and I was so excited because you remember the week prior to that. I was like, he struck, and I was so excited, and then he didn't eat it. So I was like totally I was worried about him last week, and he ate it, and I was super excited. And so because he's so little, I can't wait till he gets a little bigger. You know what I mean? Misha, now
he's so adorable. He really is. Like a little yellow worm. He's so sweet.
I tell him that when I'm holding him. I'm like, you're just a little fat inchworm. Because he's just so little. And Misha, on the other hand, went through this growth spurt in the last couple of months. And she's getting to the point where when you approach her, you're like, sweet girl, you remember me, right? You're a sweet girl.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Our big snake, the Burmese, started off, he was just over a foot long, I think. It was just like a little white and yellow worm, and he's now at least 12 feet thicker. It's literally thicker than I think he's thick a bit. He's thickest part. He's almost as thick as my thigh now. So, but he's a sweet. That's the thing. It's the thing. People think, I've raised him and he's a pet and he'll know. No, they will kill you. Give them the chance. They will kill you. And this is where I think I've said before, it was a TV show, Fatal Attractions, I think it's called, where people are killed by exotic pets. And a disproportionate number of episodes are snakes. And it's either people who've got, thinking it's clever to keep venomous snakes, And it isn't, people. It really is not. Our people, we've got the big pythons, the big boas, and I think it's jolly to get them out when they're drunk and put them around the neck and what have you. And it isn't, because I know there was a good few years ago, I think it was in Canada, the guy, they owned a pet store, and they had this big python. And they just used to let it roam around the apartments upstairs. Mm-hmm. And their niece, I think it was their niece, came to stay. Oh, their twin niece, actually, came to stay. And the snake killed both of them. He crawled into the bed and killed them both. It's just how stupid do you need to be to think this? It's not like a dog. You know, you get a dog, you get a puppy, and you raise it right, and lots of love and cuddles and that, and it's going to be a faithful friend. A snake isn't. You know, they don't have mammalian emotions. They are literally cold-blooded killers, and, you know, you need to handle them as such that if given the chance, you put him around your neck, he decides to squeeze, you're dead. It's that simple. It's like, I mean, you know, people going about, dangerous dogs. I mean, we have a pit bull. I mean, she just turned a year old. She's the one that had the babies. She's a slut. But she's not dangerous. she's literally a teen mum. We call her a teen mum dog now. But we've had her since she was 5 weeks old, and she's been brought up in a loving household with other dogs. And she doesn't have an ounce of aggression in her at all. Nothing. Not a twinkle. You know, but people sort of imprint that on snakes and crocodiles and tigers and all this, and these things are wild animals, you know. So that's our PSA for this week from the Panic Room, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just hoping
that, you know, my ball pythons never get big enough to or you know, strong enough to cause me physical harm if I'm, you know.
Well, they shouldn't. I mean, they don't much grow beyond, you know, five, maybe it's 5.5 foot for a female. But even then, my ball python is probably about near enough 5 feet. He's strong. I wouldn't put him around my neck because all it takes is a bit of a squeeze. You know, when he wraps around my arm and squeezes, it's solid muscle. So again, it doesn't take much, you know, squeeze around your neck and you can be unconscious in 30 seconds.
When I was younger, they keep squeezing,
you're dead in a few minutes.
I had a snake when I was younger, a ball python, and I would put her around my neck and we'd walk into town. And that's, you know, we would just, you know, visit people like that. And that's, you know, how he rode around on my neck like that. So I don't know. I don't want to be killed by my snake.
No, you do not. That would be bad.
Yes, yeah, very bad. Yeah.
So anyway, we could talk about snake. We need. Oh, hang on.
I know.
Got it. Carry on.
Wow! How many times did you beat that thing? I mean,
I killed him four times there. He was dead, and then I killed him some more. So, what have we got on the show this evening?
I am excited. We have two guests that, and I've said this before, I love it when we have fresh faces that we've never talked to before, because I just love getting to know the authors, and it's just so much fun getting to know people. But this week on the Panic Room, we have two award-winning authors. We have H.P. Newquist, and a little later on in the show, we have Ronald Malfi. And he's a name I've been seeing an awful lot of in the horror groups on Facebook as well. So I'm excited to talk to both of them. Okay.
That's brilliant. That's true. Well, I think before we start rambling on again, we should bring on our first guest.
Yes, our first guest is award-winning author H.P. Newquist.
Hello, how are you?
We are, well, between marauding flies and killer snakes, we're doing all right. How about you?
You know, good. You know, I feel like I walked back into my high school bedroom. My My brother used to raise snakes and piranhas. And he kept ball pythons and piranhas. And in between, he kept white mice that he would breed and feed them to both sides. And
oh, wow.
So our afternoons were spent watching white mice try to swim above piranhas and avoid ball pythons.
Oh, no.
So you guys,
no.
So this has been a bit of nostalgia already.
Nice.
Yeah, brilliant. No, it's funny. I remember in England when I was at university, piranhas, you could just buy them at the pet store. They banned them. Well, they had to ban them because people were just, they'd buy them when they got a bit too big. They just let them go. And there was an article I read in a UK newspaper, oh, that was about last year, that there was a lake in Doncaster, which is where I was brought up. I remember the lake, actually, and all the ducks sort of went. And then somebody was fishing, and they actually fished out this, like, foot-long piranha. So the lake was – and they found out that they'd eaten pretty much everything. I mean, the ducks, the other fish, you name it. Because, again, people just chucked these piranhas, got fed up with them and chucked them in the lake, which you're not supposed to do, people. But they are banned.
No,
I don't know about in America now. Because I know the exotic pet laws, certainly in Texas. I don't know if it's true or not, but there's more captive tigers in Texas than there are in the wild now, which is a bizarre statistic.
Well, I know that in Arizona, which is where we lived at the time, they outlawed piranhas because it's a canal system, an open canal system. And they were afraid that people would dump their piranhas into the open water. And they would swim up and down the state, basically eating anything that moved.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's like in Florida, in the Everglades, they have the problem with pythons, which they put out. There was a python rescue place that got hit by a hurricane, and because that blew down, the pythons got out, and they just bred like wildfire, and they just. They have sort of annual python hunts where people go and for each one they kill, they get $100 or whatever, because it's such an ecological problem again, because they get big and they eat anything.
Everything.
If they will eat it. They're just destroying the local ecosystem, which is why now, certainly, I know we were lucky. We only just managed to bring our Burmese over from England. And now, if I wanted to move state, I couldn't take him with us. It's actually illegal to move him between states.
What would you do with him? Like, what would they expect you to do with him?
I don't know. Turn him into a zoo, or I could sell him.
Oh, wow.
I have a license to keep him, but you need another different license to sell.
Right.
I don't know.
Couldn't you put him in Loch Ness?
We could do that. It's a bit of a trip, but
isn't that the best place to put creatures?
Apparently so. Well, have you heard the latest about Loch Ness? And I don't know how convoluted this is, but they reckon that the famous picture is actually of a whale's hard on. If you Google it, people. If you Google, whale erections, they do look at them because because they show off, obviously, because they're huge. They like to poke it above the water, and it looks a lot like the. But then again, what a whale was doing in Loch Ness, nobody seems to want to explain that one away.
But is there anybody who wants
you're
to
good,
have
so,
whale
you're good,
erection
somebody,
on?
One of you two is Googling this. You are, aren't you?
I just did. Yes. Is Loch Ness Monster's long neck a whale penis? I'm looking at right now I'm looking at it.
Do you really want to have that on your search history?
No, you see, we're HP, we're writers. Our search history would have us hung, drawn, and quartered anyway. Mine is just horrific. I a few years ago, I actually Googled and then worked it out. How many cans of Mountain Dew it would take to dissolve a prostitute. I have that figure somewhere in my notes. I know exactly how, because I based it on, because I watched a thing, somebody dissolved a mouse in Mountain Dew, and I worked it off that. And I forget how many cans it is, but you could buy enough cans of Mountain Dew to dissolve a hooker. So there you go, people.
Wow, you must have a really great browser history.
Oh, it's terrifying. It's terrifying, yeah.
Wow, yeah. Well, HP, you are here to talk to us about your book, Behemoth, a mysterious car accident puts off a series of disappearances in a small and quiet town. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, Behemoth is, you know, we're talking about monsters. It's really a story about, are monsters real or not? And it takes place in a small New England town where people start disappearing after three young men go out for a joyride drunkenly and smash into what they think is a monument, but they actually release something in the town. And over time, people find that whatever has come out from behind the barrier that they've hit may or may not be real, or may or may not be historical, or may not be demonic. And the story follows the trail of death to what is not a very likely conclusion, but is certainly a horrific one.
Oh, fantastic. That sounds, I love stuff like that, the dark secrets, especially, you know, in small town America. Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say it's very much small town America, and given the current climate of America and small town America, it does involve religious beliefs and those who do believe and those who don't, and how far those who do believe will go to protect their secrets.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, so I thought Xtina, I think we've lost Xtina there for a moment, but it's funny, actually, I said in the intro, I just moved house and I was driving, I'm not sure where I was driving, actually, but I came across Old Spring, which is, like, I'm in Spring, and it's like the old, and it was like going back in time to the 40s and 50s, all the lovely old buildings and and in the back of my writer's mind, I'm thinking, you know, I may never find that again. I might go looking for it, and it never really was there. Because you hear about some people, they allegedly slip back in time. So it could be, yeah, you never know. Maybe it was never there in the first place.
Well, I think that no matter where you live, you always find stories of something horrific that happened down the street something that was kept secret a few blocks away. And you always wonder what actually happened when the incident occurred. And this story is about that, going back and trying to find out what happened in the past and then finding out whether it really still exists or not. And if it does, what are the repercussions for those that are still alive to confront it?
Yeah, I definitely want to. I definitely want to hear more. I have been watching recently the ghost shows that they play on whatever station that is. But it's a different, you know, they go to the different supposedly haunted locations. And I don't know what I think anymore. I really don't, because some of them really just freak me out a little bit, you know. And thinking. I don't know. I mean, for me, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do any of them. And just recently we found this show that I remember watching when I was, I think it was came out like 2000 or something like that. It was called MTV's Fear. And, like, I don't know if anybody remembers the show, because it was only on for like a season and a half.
Yeah. That was like 15, 20 years ago almost.
Yeah, and they would make them do certain dares, like, you know, go to this location and you have to, you know what, I don't care how much money they offered me, I couldn't have done any of them, none of them. And it kind of makes me feel like a chicken shit when I say that, but, you know, I think it's because I do believe that there's something out there that, and I don't always believe it's you know, benign or it's, you know, like some of the things I can say to myself, well, I think that might be just a, what do they call it? Residual, like a residual thing going on. And that sounds scary when you think about it, but, you know, demonic or anything like that. And I'm out. You know, I have a friend who's always telling me she hears strange noises or something weird happened in the other room. And I'm like, it's time to move.
Leave the house. Just leave it.
Yeah, well, I couldn't stay. Yeah.
And that's exactly what I wanted to do with Behemoth is there something real at the bottom of all of this? And even though we think it might be imaginary, what if you did find that there was that something real that was causing all of this and you confronted the reality of that? And I think in real life, we all kind of in the back of our heads would like to think, Jesus, what if that was an actual thing and I actually had to face it? And that's the beauty of being able to write about things like that.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and yet without having to physically face it. Although I've often said I would love to meet a ghost. I really would. I would love, you know, to be able to believe, you know, just meet a ghost and have a chat and see what all that's about. That would be fantastic. As long as it was a nice ghost. None of you, you know, I don't want a scary one, just a nice one.
Like Casper, the friendly ghost?
Yeah, Casper or... Oh, the what was it, Slimer from Ghostbusters? I always wanted to one of those.
Yeah.
He was great, you know, that sort of. He was fun. A fun ghost. Not as scary like on Poltergeist and whatnot.
Right, something that's going to rip your head off.
I'd rather avoid those ghosts. But for me, with you obviously intrigue me now. I mean, for me, demons are my thing. You know, I love it. Again, it's kind of, I guess, in a way, Lovecraftian as well, the thought of, you know, demons and hideous things lurking just behind the veneer of reality. I like that. That really appeals to me.
Yeah, same here. And they're lurking, but they're just close enough that they can affect your life. They can reach in and dabble and mess with what's going on in your life and then withdraw to the point where no one else believes what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
I want to hear more. I think we have an excerpt to play. Do you need to set it up or anything, HP?
Yeah, this is from the audiobook, which is just about to be released, the audio version of Behemoth. And as we were talking about earlier, an accident has occurred in a little town, and it's three drunk boys have gone in a car sort of spree, and they've crashed the car, and the car has hit something and released something. And this, which you're hearing now, is something that occurs another town over an hour after the crash, and the person who's involved here knows nothing of the crash, but they experienced the result of it.
Okay, and I shall press the button, hopefully the right button. Here we go.
Chapter 5, April 4th, Thursday, 11:55 p.m. It was almost midnight in Ashford. Billy McGrath walked alone down the middle of Main Street, weaving. He needed fresh air. Cold air. He needed it to infuse his body and needed it to clear his head. Hands deep in his pockets, Billy squinted against the wind and the cold. His eyes watered and glistening tears froze at the corners of his eyelids. His brain ached from his wife's yelling. Christ. They'd been married 2 months and she was already bitching at him. Tonight it was about how much time he spent playing video games. Billy decided that instead of yelling back, he would go for a walk, because if he didn't get out of the house, he might throw something at her, and that something might be heavy, and it might be his fist. Ashford was empty. It always was after 9 o'clock. The town's traffic lights had switched over to blinking yellow caution mode. No green, no red. Everything was closed, including the town's 3 restaurants and 4 fast food places. Even the convenience store shut down at 10:30, belying a promise to be open from 7 to 11. Nothing in town moved, nothing but shadows that danced a two-step as yellow traffic lights flashed in a blaring throb of silence. Billy wanted to see if the door to the store was unlocked. He could use another beer, even if he had to steal it. Barely anyone locked their doors in Ashford, not like over in the village of Morris. People in Morris supposedly triple-locked their doors at sundown, and they stayed inside till after sunrise. Billy didn't know why he was thinking about Morris, but it took his mind off the beer. He decided not to rob the convenience store. He'd heard that Morris people didn't trust anybody from outside their town. They were snooty, antisocial, and paranoid. Maybe you could only understand Morris if you lived there, he said to himself. Still and all, nobody in Ashford cared about what went on in Morris. Billy certainly didn't. That was about to change. There was a car accident in Morris tonight. A bad one. The car was sitting wrecked in a field, radiator still steaming. It wouldn't be discovered until tomorrow morning. There had been three boys in the car. What remained of them wouldn't be found until much later. Billy McGrath didn't know about the accident. He walked to the end of Main Street and turned down Salisbury Road. That was where all the hardware stores and lumber sheds were. Big yards with chicken wire fences encircling pipes, bricks, and concrete sacks stacked high on pallets. He walked past them, away from the town center and deeper into the darkness. Salisbury Road dead-ended into barren lots and scrub bushes. It was a flat expanse of nothing. An abyss. Off in the distance were houses, all dark. Not even the wraith flicker of TV lights. Billy gazed into the blackness. He thought he'd be able to see the lights of his house from here. He couldn't. Resting a moment, he leaned against the chicken wire fence. His head began to lighten, as if toxin was seeping out of it. He could feel it. The walk was doing him good. Something growled. Cocking his head, Billy heard gravel rattling on the far side of the empty lot. He squinted and peered. It sounded like a dog tramping around one of the contractor sheds. The noise it made was strange, though. A little creepy. It was a hollow grunt, a snarl. Billy walked on, more slowly. His thoughts returned to more important things. Goddamned wife, man. She's driving me nuts. He watched his steaming breath as it wisped out against the black sky. He tried to blow smoke rings that vanished too quickly. The odd noise came again, louder. This time, it echoed, like several low voices murmuring. Wariness crept into his head. One dog was fine, but more could be a problem. He'd once seen a pack of wild dogs tear up a full-grown elk while he was hunting. He heard clumps of gravel skittering across the ground, moving towards him. Billy caught his breath, and it trailed away in a truncated puff of air. Freaking dog, he thought to himself, trying to calm down. If he had to, he knew he could run back up the street and get up over a fence. Hopefully it wasn't a wolf or a coyote. That would suck. The growling noise was louder and closer. He heard something else in the grunting now. Something wet, dripping. Billy started walking backwards. He eased toward the pulsing light of the intersection and the false safety of the deserted storefronts. He tried to imagine what was making that noise in the dark. It sounded bigger than a dog. Much bigger. Maybe an escaped animal. From a zoo or a circus or something. The sound. Again. Grinding. Closer. Louder. The sound swelled around him. The hair stood up on his neck. The skin on his arms crawled. A monstrous thing stepped into the street. It rose over him, blocking the light. Billy saw his stalker. He whimpered out loud, unable to help himself. He almost got enough air into his throat to scream. Almost. The thing attacked him. For 10 seconds. 20. 30. Then Billy was gone. Forever. That night, he was the only one who saw exactly what death looked like. Even those three boys, whose car now sat empty and quiet in a Morris field, hadn't seen the horror coming.
Wow.
There you have it.
We need,
wow.
We need more. Yeah, every single time. We need more. You can't end there. You just
And that's just the beginning. So the ending is further, much further along.
Wow. You know, I wanted to ask because I saw, I think when I went to the Amazon page to look at your bio, you don't just write horror. You write other genres as well.
Yeah, I've actually been writing for years, and mostly I write weird science, so things like the history of blood research or a book called This Will Kill You about all the different ways we die and what happens to you when you die. And horror has been something I've wanted to do for a long time, but it's always kind of taken a back seat to my day job of writing these other books. So Behemoth was my first opportunity to kind of let loose the horror.
Nice. I like that. So is it definitely something you're going to come back to? Did you, you know, oh, I love this. So I got to keep doing it.
It is. It's this Behemoth's been really well received, and people have asked for either a prequel or a sequel. And, you know, now I'll have to think about where that could go. And there are some other ideas that I'd like to tie into that. But definitely horror, ever since I was a kid, was my most favorite genre to read, from Edgar Allan Poe to H.P. Lovecraft to Stephen King, you know, on and on and on. And I, you know, if one could do that every day of the week, that would be a great life.
Definitely, definitely. That was definitely, you know, one of the questions I'd like to ask everyone is, you know, you mentioned Stephen King, so what's your favorite Stephen King book?
You know, the book, not the movie, of The Shining. The Shining, on its first reading, there's a chapter in there that just takes place in the elevator, and I find that to be the best horror chapter ever written. And
really?
King,
nice.
And, you know, King gets his bad rap for, you know, whatever people think of how many books he's written or how he ends the books. But I think his early work, especially Night Shift and Carrie and The Shining and Salem's Lot, are just beautiful, thrilling works of horror.
Yeah, speaking of his earlier stuff, we just watched Firestarter, and is
another great
movie.
Yeah.
Yes, and the movie really stands up. It really does. I heard that they're redoing it. I think maybe.
Yeah,
I heard that they are.
But now Drew Barrymore can play. Yeah, Drew Barrymore can play like the grandmother now.
She could. Yes, she could. And again, I remember read Firestarter, the book. I mean, brilliant. I actually sat and read that in one sitting. I just couldn't
wow.
put that down. The book, Christine, I mean, the film was okay, but the book was phenomenal. Loved the book.
And the thing that King did so well was the supernatural element of horror. I mean, there's plenty of blood and plenty of gore, but there was always that sinister, demonic element that really, at least to me, was kind of crucial to making a great horror story, that unknown that came out of nowhere and changed people's lives.
The only thing I think that I could say about the movie Firestarter was that I wish they had more about the shop. That really fascinated me. So I was definitely wanting more of that. So if they did do a remake or reboot or whatever, if they would incorporate a little more of that, I might watch it.
All these years later, we might find out the shop was real.
As long as they do a better job than they did with Pet Sematary, then
that was
just
bad.
Terrible. I'm sorry. It was awful.
Cujo.
Yeah, Cujo was great.
Yeah. Anytime you think of a bad dog, you can call it Cujo, and everybody knows what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the book was very good, even as a King doesn't remember writing it, allegedly. You know, he was that high on coke at the time. He doesn't. But again, brilliant book. I much prefer his earlier stuff. Although his 11/26/63, whatever it was, the time travel Kennedy one, that was, again, the end was a bit meh, but the book itself was brilliant. Loved it. Loved every word of that. Absolutely fantastic.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, his short stories and his novellas, like in Skeleton Crew and Night Shift, those are perfectly spaced out, They're perfectly, the patterns, the rhythms are just brilliant. And I think actually his shorter stuff works better than most of his longer stuff.
I would agree. Yeah. It's almost like he's given free rein. He's given free rein to do a novel, and he just doesn't know when to stop. He just keeps going.
And Stephen King, nobody will tell him. Yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah, and then, but no, I mean, again, it gets criticized. It's kind of funny in the new It, the second one, you know, where he actually gets plays a cameo as the antique store guy.
Right.
And he even pokes fun at himself about, you know, the bad endings and what have you. But there's been a few that have been, even for me, It, you know, the ending to It was a bit disappointing, in the book, a little bit disappointing,
oh, yeah.
You know. But then again, you look at, I mean, Salem's Lot is pretty much as close to a perfect novel as you could get. Absolutely. I think that was the second King novel I ever read, and it was my favorite.
Yeah, mm-hmm. After Dracula, it's probably the best-formed vampire novel ever written.
Yes, I would agree. Mm-hmm.
And in the movie, I'll just say that scene where the two boys are out the window hovering just scared the crap out of me when I was a kid.
Yeah,
that's
great.
How creeps me out. Yeah.
This is a great scene, though. But yeah, definitely. No, I'm reading Joyland right now, which is and I don't know how old it is, but it's Stephen King, and it's not really horror, but I'm digging it anyway. You know, it's
good. I read that a few years ago, and it's got a bit of a supernatural element to it, but it's a good,
yeah.
I guess, a coming of age sort of thing. But again, it's very, very readable. He's infinitely readable, no matter what he writes.
Yes.
Even the people complain about the filler. Even the filler is good. I enjoy that. I really do.
Yes.
Yeah. And he does great characters. It's just hard to keep track of them after the 300th novel.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
I did see a review of something he's done, one of the newer books, and it said that his characters are pretty much just somebody from a different book. I mean, and it's funny, reading the Joyland I'm reading now, in the Jonesy, I'm like, didn't we have a Jonesy before? Wasn't there a Jonesy in one of his other books?
Yeah,
like,
you need a spreadsheet to keep track of them all.
Yeah. I mean, he has a habit of, people popping up from other books, which is, like you say, because he's created this, around Derry and Castle Rock sort of...
Castle Rock, sure.
...thing. But it is strange, I have to say.
Yeah,
you say it's. I remember reading. I think it was Cujo. Yeah, Sheriff Bannerman. He gets killed by Cujo. Spoiler alert. And I think I know that name. And he was in a previous one. I forget which one it was, but he popped up in. And it's nice that it's all interlinked. I kind of like that. Gets away with it. You know, he does it well.
Well, it gets the Castle Rock mythos is almost like the Cthulhu mythos, in Rhode Island. You've got all these people coming in and out of different stories, but they're all part of the same weird part of America.
Yeah, yeah. But it works. I mean, apparently, I've never read the Dark Tower series. It never really appealed to me, but apparently that's sort of pivotal to the whole King multiverse sort of thing,
which is
intriguing.
Well, I was going to ask you, HP, what are you working on now?
I have a non-horror book that comes out in a month called Scene of the Crime, which is about the history of forensic science, like how fingerprinting and DNA and Sherlock Holmes all contributed to modern crime fighting. But I do have another horror book that is currently being shopped, as they say, called The School of Infinite Pain. And it's
nice
a collection
title.
Of...
That sounds fun.
Yeah, I think we've all lived in our own schools of infinite pain. But I'm hoping that will be out sometime early next year.
No, brilliant.
Definitely. We'll definitely have to. I'll have to come stalking you to come on the show when that gets closer.
Please.
Yeah.
Please, please do. I'm eminently stockable. I'm happy to be stocked.
Brilliant.
I think we're just about out of time for this segment, but let us know where we can find you online.
I have a website at www.newquist.net, which also newquistbooks.com, and you can find all my books and all my horror there.
Awesome. Everybody who is listening, go out and buy Behemoth by H.P. Newquist. And I love having you on. I can't wait till we talk to you again. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you. You guys were great. And enjoy your pythons and your flies with their heads on a spike.
Yeah, there's still one. That the final fly is still before the end of the show. I promise I'm going to get it. I will get it. So again,
well,
thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Have a good night. Bye bye.
You too.
I'm gonna. We're gonna have a break. So I'm gonna have a wee. I'm gonna see if I can get this fly during the break. So we will be right back.
Panic Room Radio Show is brought to you by Hellbound Books Publishing, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher, along with links to all of their available works across platforms, at hellboundbookspublishing.com. In the mood for something steamy to read? Check out erotica author Jennifer Lynn at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James and Xtina at their respective websites, jameslongmore.com for James and darkpoetprincess.com for Xtina. Don't forget to follow The Panic Room on social media, Facebook unofficial, The Panic Room Radio Show, our Vimeo channel with all of our previous shows, the new Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website, www.panicroomradio.com.
Stop you.
welcome back to part two.
Well, we is back. We is back. That was a great first segment there.
It was.
It's interesting, you know, when you speak to authors who write such a varied, varied range of things. Some of the stuff there, the whole forensic thing, I think, probably appeals to any horror writer,
Definitely.
But then again, you could tell he's written, he's hooked. he's obviously on his next one, so he's hooked on horror. And I think we all do. I mean, it's one of those things. I grew up, always liked the scary stuff from being little. You know, the ghost stories and graduated to the Hammer horror films as a kid and horror movies and always been. And my mother used to despair. She used to think I was some sort of, twisted evil. But maybe she was right in many ways. But she did her best to try and stop me. Of course, kids being kids, the more she tried to stop me, the more I didn't. But,
I wanted to say, I just completed my collection of our Hellbound books, and it is such a gorgeous bookshelf. It really is. And
I'm so jealous you've done that.
I know.
I stopped a couple of years ago because I just got,
things got rough.
But we'll probably publish another 40 or 50 since I stopped. So.
I look over at it so many times a day and I'm like, oh, there's so gorgeous books on that shelf. And
so you have every one now.
I think there are a couple that I was having difficulty, like maybe in one of the authors who are no longer with us or something like that. But so maybe like three or four that I couldn't get. But it's just gorgeous bookshelf. It is.
I'm gonna have to do the same. I mean, now I've got my house, I can put shelves up. And it's funny because there's like a built-in bookshelf in the living room, and I brought my little bookshelf with me, and they're full. They're just full already. And I've still got two big the big moving boxes. I've got two of those that I packed up from the previous house and didn't unpack them because I didn't have room at my the rental we just moved from. Even my daughter says you got a lot of books.
I'm gonna have to sort them out. We have this amazing little used bookstore not too far away, and even Sean loves it too. He tries to get us to go, go there all the time. Anytime we leave the house, he's like, are we gonna go to Johnson City because that's where that. And that's all he's got his mindset on is that bookstore. And it is wonderful. And I have started trying to build up my collection of the Stephen King hardcovers because, they have a ton of them. And and so every time I go, I try to weasel one or two out,
my life took a different turn. I was going the other way. I was sort of collecting signed books. I got the signed Scarlet Gospels, the Clive Barker. I got a signed James Herbert, which I absolutely treasure. Chuck Palahniuk.
I just love him.
And I've got a couple of others, but I want a signed Stephen King, obviously. That's going to be my thing. I'm going to sort of go for the signed. It's funny that there's a friend now, who owns a couple of bookstores, one in Houston, one in Galveston. And that's what they specialize in. So I can say to him, get me a signed Stephen King, and he will get me a signed Stephen King, pay for it. But, they specialize in getting rare and first editions and signed copies and all the rest of it. So I turn to them.
I do have a bookshop now with just my signed books from the guests who come on the show, and that's
of course you must have a million of those.
I love it. I love them. I love it so much. I do. I just do you know how many times a day? I don't know about times a day anymore, but I'll go over and just like, you know, pet the shelf.
You lick,
like,
lick
oh,
them, don't
you?
You lick them.
I'll never tell.
You're going to lick my books now. Well, it's fine. I often pop outside and lick my car, so it kind of works out there. So, speaking of licking things, who have we got coming up next?
That's a great introduction for him.
Isn't it just? He's probably not going to come on now. I wouldn't.
Right. No, I'm gonna introduce him, and you're gonna push the button, and he'll be there because he.
Well,
I'm gonna
push a button. So who knows?
All right, our next guest of the evening is award-winning author Ronald Malfi. Yay!
Hello.
I thought about remaining silent just after that comment, just to make you guys think I hung up. But yeah.
Oh God.
I will do my best to make sure Xena does not lick you, but I can't promise a thing.
Not a problem. It's cool. Well, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us.
You're another one of those names that I have been seeing over and over in one of these horror books, groups, and Facebook, and I'm like, oh, we got to get him. So here you are. Yay.
Well, here I am. There you go. All right.
There's no escape.
That's right. It's late here, so I'm not going to run. I'm just, you've got me.
There you go. Whereabouts are you? Where are you calling from?
I am calling from right outside of Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh, right. So you're an hour ahead. Is that right?
Eastern Standard Time, yeah.
Yeah, we already discussed that's like the only real time. It's, you know, you weird.
Well, that's the thing. I get so many of
these,
you know, I do a bunch of these kind of things, and everybody agrees on a time. And then, you know, like an hour before the show, everybody's like scrambling to go, wait a minute, what time did you actually mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We, you know, it's funny, we've talked to people all around the world, actually. We've had, you know, so many different countries we've talked to. And I remember being one time, we had a guest on that was, I don't know, I'm going to say he was in New York or something, and the connection was just crappy. It was awful. And then our next guest was calling from Vietnam. And
It was like he was in the next room. It was funny. Yeah.
I was like, that's insane. Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. And tonight I've had to call in on my phone. So I feel all like, you know, I couldn't figure out where to push the button to mute myself. And it wasn't on the computer where it normally is. So I apologize for that weird, awkward silence earlier. But I'm not used to being on my phone anymore doing this. So hoping it sounds okay.
That sounds good by me.
Yeah, but you're here to talk to us about your book, Come With Me. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so it just came out July 20th, and it's a story about a guy whose wife, in the beginning, it's not a spoiler, it's in the beginning of the book, his wife is killed in a mall shooting. And after her death, he kind of goes through her stuff and realizes that she had this entire really dark history and obsession that she was pursuing behind his back throughout their marriage. And he kind of picks up the reins where she left off and pursues it for her in the wake of her death. And I mean, that's the elevator pitch, but yeah.
I have to say, you know, no spoilers or anything. I just got the book in the mail today, and I was, you know, I do this sometimes. I get it, and I will, you know, I read the back and I read a couple pages just to kind of get a feel for it. And next thing you know, I'm putting down the book I was reading and reading, and I'm like, man, it's going to happen again, isn't it? Because, I don't know, it just sounded very interesting, and, you know, already, so just the feel of it, and the fact that, you know, he's talking to her, kind of, and, you know, it does make you think, as close as you think you are to your spouse or, you know, to your best friend or to, you know, whatever, there's always things you don't know. And I don't think you really think about that until you're presented with it. And, you know, then you're like, wow, it's a weird feeling, you know, because I guess that, you know, I'm married and I think to myself, you know, I know him really well. I know everything about him, but do I? Mm-hmm. So,
no,
it's kinda
exactly.
Creepy. Yeah.
And, you know, just the narrative voice that I went with in the book, and it took me a while to find what kind of voice I wanted to use. And I must have written that first chapter a bunch of times in, you know, kind of a standard third person. And then I went to first person. I was going back and forth. It just didn't ring true to me. And then it just kind of clicked one day where I'm like, you know, it's sort of this bastardization of a second person voice told by in first person, but to the reader as his dead wife. And once I realized that, I'm like, ah, that's it. And everything just kind of fell into place. Just felt so natural and human, the way that the characters started thinking and talking, that the book just kind of took off once I found, you know, once I found that little, the open window into who he was. And, you know, it kind of took off from there.
Yeah. I'm definitely very intrigued, and I can't wait to. It's another one of those times where I, you know, when you leave it, when you put it down, I'm thinking, you know, what's going to happen next? What's going on? What's, you know, where am I getting to? And like I said, I was reading something to begin with, and now I'm mad because I have to put it down again. I'm going to forget where I was. But there are worse things, I suppose, than that. So I'm not going to complain too much. So, so you said this book just came out in July. And are you, you know, so do you have something else that you've already started, or do you give yourself a little time to kind of, you know, breathe afterwards, or what?
I wish. I'm kind of the most busiest that I've been now that I have in the past few years, because I was doing a book a year for the past like 10 years. So I would do like these 3 book contracts with different publishers. And so every year I was writing a new novel, and the older I got, and, you know, I had, you know, once I had kids and, you know, life kind of got in the way of everything, it got harder and harder to do that. So back in like, it was around 2017, my book, Bone, I wrote a book called Bone White. It was the final book of a book deal that I had with Kensington Books. And after that, they wanted me to do another 3 books. I was just exhausted. I said, you know what, I'm just going to take some time and chill out. So I wrote Come With Me during that period of downtime, and it was the first book I wrote in about a decade that was not under contract. I had no obligation. I could just write whatever I wanted to write, and what came, you know, out, you know, whatever came out, that's what I was going to do. And so it was extremely freeing. It was a little nerve-wracking because I didn't have a book deal, but it was very freeing creatively. So I did that, and, you know, COVID hit, and that kind of – you know, publishing grinded to a halt in New York. Nobody knew what was going on. So everything kind of, once I finished it, it kind of sat in stasis a little bit for a while. But then when we sold it, and they came back and said, all right, well, we want to do, so they wanted to do like 2 more books. And they're like back to back. So my downtime, which I was going to take some downtime after that. And I did, I probably should have jumped on the second book quicker than I did, because I'm writing it now, and I'm coming up on an October 1st deadline, and I started in June, so yeah, but I got to jump on the next one after that. So it's been really busy lately, but that's good, because, you know, sitting home and most of the world's not doing a whole lot, so that's been fine.
Right. Yeah, I suppose, you know, kind of piggybacking on that question, how hard is it to, you know, write the end of in your, you know, that's the world, you're closing the door on that, and then you're going on to something else. Like, is it hard to transition?
The hard part of transitioning. So, and when I'm done with the book, I'm really just kind of done with it. I feel like I've said everything I needed to say, and I kind of celebrate it, open a bottle of wine, and say, hey, it was a good run. Have fun, go out into the world, and I'm done with it. It's like raising a kid. You don't want the kid to keep coming back, right? You want them out once they're an adult, so you send them out. What is tough is you finish one book with whoever those characters are, whatever the tone and the atmosphere and the feel of that story is, and then you've got to switch gears and jump into something else with all new characters and learn who these people are as you start telling this new story. You know, it's kind of like if you're an actor and you just come out of like a serious drama and now you've got to make like a Jim Carrey comedy like right behind it. You know, how do you switch those gears? So that's the tough part for me, is finding that voice all over again and learning who these new characters are. And usually takes a couple of, I don't really outline. So when I write, I just kind of start from the beginning of the book and see where it goes. And it takes me a few false starts until I realize, this is who this person is. And this is really what they would do. And I go back and I rewrite it and, you know, until I get it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a question there and it just, boom, you know, I'm on medication tonight, so I'm going to blame that. But, and I think it was a good question, too, so I'm going to, like, hope it comes back to me. But
it's probably the best one of the night, too.
You know what? It probably was. But I think that we have an excerpt from Come With Me, James. Are you still with us, James, or did he? Did
yes,
he
I am. I'm enjoying the show. I'm enjoying the show, so, you know, just carry on. Carry on.
She's talking to that guy from Vietnam right now.
So, yeah, do we need to set up the clip or just push play?
You know what? I'm gonna plead. I'm going to confess how lazy I was. I think when you asked me for one, I sent you the sample from the audiobook off of Amazon.
Did.
That's how terrible I am.
I'm
not even sure what the clip is.
I want to tell the story too, James. So, yeah, he sends me to Amazon, and you know how they have the little play sample. Well, I'm like, there's no button to download the sample. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? So I asked him, you know, can you get it to me a different way? He's like, you know what? I'm going to confess I really don't know how. So I'm like, I don't either. And I'm like trying to figure it out. And his boyfriend, he is a computer programmer. And I said, hey, honey. And, you know, he did a little, you know, computer. And a few minutes later, I had to download it. And I'm not going to lie, it was super hot.
And he could just confess that he's illegally pirating all these audiobooks now in the free time.
Absolutely.
Oh gosh, that was so funny. But yes, it's just the samples.
So it's a lucky dip. Then we're gonna get what we're gonna get. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I'll be as surprised as you guys. We'll talk about it after we hear it. This way I know what
it
is.
Right. On that note, I'm going to press the button. I roll the tape.
There with your head down, a dark silhouette, getting drenched in the middle of a springtime downpour. I watched you from beneath the awning of the marina snack bar, curious about this lone figure bobbing along the choppy waters in the storm. Admittedly, I didn't even know you were female at first. The distance between us, confused by the rain, made you look like an indistinguishable, immovable lump, sorry to say. I started to formulate a story about you, and how you ended up floating out there in the rain on that boat, that maybe you were contemplating suicide after suffering a broken heart, or maybe you were already dead, a casualty of a jealous lover who had propped your body upright on that boat before casting you out toward the bay. The scenario only grew increasingly more peculiar when three figures emerged from the water around you, slick as seals in their black wetsuits, and climbed into the boat with you. Only then did you move, a slight tilt of your head, perhaps to posit a question or to extend an order. One of the wet-suited fellows engaged the outboard motor and the John boat carved a wide arc around the channel of the creek. When it stopped again, farther away from me, I watched as the wetsuits dropped over the side of the boat and vanished again beneath the turbulent, storm-churned surface of the water. You remained curled there in the rain, a dark semicolon rocking on the waves, your head down as if scrutinizing something life-changing in your lap. and the boat ultimately dropped you off at the marina before vanishing into the rainy mist. You had on an army green slicker, your dark and shiny hair pulled back into a soaking wet ponytail. Your face was unblemished, almost boyish. You carried a notebook and a camera in a see-through waterproof bag. I watched you from across the sparse floor of the marina snack bar as you took up a table far from me, ordered a coffee, black, no sugar, and began scribbling furiously in your notebook. For the next 20 minutes, I alternated between reading a Japanese language edition of a Haruki Murakami novel and watching you. Finally, when I had summoned enough courage to approach, you didn't even look up at me as you said, "We were searching for a dead body." This statement, a lie you would later confess, you were out with divers from the Naval Academy examining oyster beds for an article you were writing for a local newspaper, rendered me speechless. And when you did look up at me, I could see that this had been your intention all along, to render me speechless, to knock me off kilter. And that was when I thought for the first time, who is this girl? So, in that regard, I can hardly blame you for your darkness. I can hardly claim that I was caught unawares by this most recent development. Not completely. I had been forewarned by the first thing you had ever said to me. The first words out of your mouth to a tall, gangly stranger with reading glasses and a chunky, tattered Japanese paperback in his hands. A lie meant as a joke that edged on darkness. Who is this girl? After your death, and after 5 years of what I would consider a pretty goddamn good marriage, I found myself asking that very same question all over again. 3. No one thinks when they first meet a person that there is some cosmic clock counting down the years, months, weeks, days, hours, minutes, seconds, until you will stop knowing each other. It doesn't occur to most people when you meet the person with whom you wish to spend the rest of your life that, at some point, one of you will leave. Sure, everyone knows this on a practical level. Everyone dies. No one lives forever. But no one looks their spouse in the eye on the night of their wedding and actually hears the ticking of that clock. Its sound is buried far beneath the flash and glamour of what we think our futures hold for us. But it's there. Don't be fooled. It ticks for all of us. You, Allison, my wife, died on an unseasonably warm and rather peaceable December morning, all things considered. At the time of your death, I was most likely wrapping your Christmas present, wistfully ignorant that you were hemorrhaging blood onto a scuffed linoleum floor. I was still in bed when you left the house that morning. Awake, but with my eyes closed against the bright sheet of daylight pressed against the bedroom windows. I ran a hand along your side of the bed as I stirred. The sheets were cold.
Yeah, again, we need more of that, so.
That was good. Yeah. I have to say, a little bit grim, but...
Yeah.
We like grim on this show. We do like grim.
And that's how it starts, too. Like, a lot of that was what I had read, before the show. So, yeah, that's how it starts. So where does it go from there? No, but I remembered my question from earlier when I had that awful brain fart there.
Sure.
You know, you said that when you finish a book, you're done. That's it, and you're done with the book. And James is the same way, But I always wonder, do the characters ever keep talking after the book is done? Like, I mean, do you ever have that where you're like, well, maybe they weren't completely done. Maybe there's a sequel or something in store for them.
Honestly, most of the time they don't. I think for me, once they've said their piece and kind of walked off into the sunset, I think they're kind of done. There have been things I've written on occasion where I do wonder where things would go, where some of the characters, I wrote a book a few years ago called December Park, and it's about five kids growing up in the 90s. Who are trying to track down a serial killer in their town called the Pied Piper, and it's you know, autobiographical as in I put me and my friends in basically as the characters, but nice. You know, we're fictionalized versions of ourselves, and clearly we weren't chasing down a serial killer. But you know, that story kind of, you know, the characters in the book are 13, 14 or so years old, and you know, I always wonder, I'm like, ah, you know, where would those characters be? Because they wound up becoming so different than the real people that I based them on, that I kind of wondered where I'd see them in real life. And I do kind of have an idea of where some of them would be and might revisit it someday. But very rare do I wonder what some of these characters are doing now. I think I put them through enough terrible things.
Well, as a reader, sometimes we want to know. I know that there's this a series that I loved so much, and it was a 10-book series. So, you know, that's a lot. And, you know, mm-hmm. So of course when the authors were done, they were done. And I'm like, you know,
yeah.
Can't we get like a newsletter every so often, you know, something like that, you know, and no, they won't even do that. It's awful.
Well, it's
but,
almost tougher with that because you spend like, you know, 10 books over, you know, if they're doing a book a year, that's a decade of your life you've spent with those characters, right? So it is like losing a relationship, you know, when you're done.
Yeah.
So that's tough.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, like, you know, I talked about this on the show before. I'm a huge Friends fan. I love the show to pieces, and I've seen every episode, I don't know how many times. And, you know, when I'm sick, I want to turn on Friends. When I, you know, when we go on vacation and on the TV, I find Friends. So, I mean, it's just crazy, crazy Friends nut. And it's been so long since, you know, the show was on air. I just... You know, they even talk about they had a Yeller on the show. They talk about they had a family newsletter. And I think that the fans should get this. I think that we should get this so we can know what's going on. So it's just not fair to the fans. Yeah, yeah.
You should hit up Warner Brothers and see if they'll hire you to write it.
I'm telling you, maybe I should write some fanfic or something. Yeah. Well, Ronald, I think we are getting close to the end of our show, and we had such a good time with you. You have to promise to come back.
Sure, no, this is great. No problem. Sounds good.
I love how I wait there. It can be, you know, and it can be awkward if you want it to be, if you know, but I'm going to pressure you into saying yes, so you don't really have a choice.
No, I have a strict policy that if I'm not going to come back on a show, I actually say it on the air while they ask me. So you're good.
Oh, fun. I like that. I like that. Well done, you.
So let us know where we can find you online.
You know, all the usual places that everybody else has got. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. My website is ronaldmalfi.com, which I don't really update. So, but yeah, you can hit me up on Facebook and Twitter, and also my most response will probably come from I'm in a band, so the band website gets a lot of stuff there, veerband.net. So if you want to go there and shoot a message in, you'll probably get a quicker response. But yeah, so that's it. That's me, cyber me.
Awesome. And yeah, I can't wait to have you back. But all of our listeners out there, go out and buy Come With Me by Ronald Malfi. And can't wait till we have you back. Thank you so much.
Great.
Yeah,
thanks
you for
guys.
Joining us. Absolutely appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Have a great night. Cheers.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Take care, guys.
Bye. Night.
Well, time has beaten us again, and it does. As it
yay.
Does. You say, you know, time flies when you're having fun. I we do have fun. This, sadly, this is the highlight of my week. This is as good as it gets for Jimbo, I'm afraid. So on that jolly note, it is time to say goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Yeah, goodnight.
As I gaze around at these strangers in town. I guess the only stranger is me. And
I wonder,
yes, I wonder,
oh, I wonder,
is this the way life's meant to be? Although it's only